first.
Do you mind if we eat first?
No, I'm not.
We're not in a hurry, my friend.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, just relax, for God's sake.
I'm just pleased to see you, that's all.
Yeah, no, I'm not, you know, I'm not, what's the word? I told you, it's still giving a very rough business in our family. A rift, I told you.
Oh, right, with Mickey or something.
Yeah, did Harold mention it?
No.
No, it's very sensibly.
No, we just talked about, he may have mentioned it in passing. Yeah, I've got a list of things which are about sort of side issues and sort of thing they do at South Place.
Oh yeah.
I thought I'd ask you about, yeah, you know, about,
well,
politics.
I Barbara Smoke, oh my God.
She's an interesting woman, isn't she?
Yeah, she is. Mixed up. She will broke me.
No, I won't put you. No, I like her. Like, she's a bit dogmatic, isn't she? You know?
Well, I told you, I think she's an inverted Roman Catholic.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I think she went back in the church.
So, on her deathbed?
Yes,
thing.
Of course.
Yeah, maybe.
I think all her relatives all hovering around and waiting for the deathbed to go.
Well, they can always make it up, and if it doesn't happen,
even better. there's something about it. I find people who are too anti, I get worried, because I wonder whether it's sort of some great psychological problem rather than an objective thing. I remember once, there was a meeting at Conway Hall one morning and someone mentioned Jesus and said, if I hear that word Jesus, I'll walk out of the room. I mean, that's going slightly paranoid.
Yes, that's right.
The other thing, she was against any discussion with, she was against a debate with Donald Soper, I don't know why. She wouldn't have invited Donald Soper into the...
Someone told me that she was at a debate. And the chap walked at you, she told him he should be ashamed of himself or something like that.
Who did?
Well, the bishop or something like that.
She said to him?
Yeah, and then he walked out. Well, that was what Harold told me.
Hello.
And so they had to call it off.
Really?
Well,
I believe it.
Well, I don't see why they should call it off, because the bloke walked out.
Pardon?
I don't see why they should call it off.
Who called it off?
Well, I think it was a TV programme.
Oh, I see. Oh, well, it's nothing to do with that. I thought it was something in Conway Hall.
No. Some TV thing. Oh, so this is what Harold told me. I don't know anything. I mean, I never...
Yeah. Well, she's involved in an exceedingly peculiar action with Nicholas Hyman. Did you know about that?
No. Legal action, you mean?
Oh, yeah, unbelievable. It's bizarre. But she's accused me of inciting him to take libel action. I was on the executive committee of the South Place Ethical Society some years ago. I don't know how I got inveigled onto it, but first of all, there's a lot of elderly people quarrelling with each other most of the time.
Yeah.
Awfully depressing about the minutes, and he said that, and I said that, and really, even the worst German manager of Labour, that can be boring. I always said, let's get back to a Labour Party meeting, It's appalling, the meeting. Anyhow, to cut a long story short, as you know, Nicholas Hyman was appointed a secretary some years ago.
All right, I met him once. He's edited, isn't he, as well?
That's right. Apparently she was one of the people who headhunted him or whatever. Now, for whatever reason, again, it's none of my blunders, I'm not terribly interested, she fell out with him. And ran a tremendous campaign to get rid of him. And formed an alliance with his wife, who started accusing him of being a philanderer, of using the money of the South Place Ethical Society to advance a property empire, and that he was engaged with developers and trying to develop Conway Hall, and he was getting a percentage. And got more and more bizarre and berserk, and I think his wife was a black lady who developed some paranoia about her husband having relations with every other girl that was around, and then going to further accusations that he was involved with developers and criminals, and he was a murderer. And
quite a varied career.
Yeah. It so happens there was a underlying element of criticism of the way he was running the society, saying he was administratively inefficient, and he didn't send a bloody notice out of time, which I think is a perfectly fair point of view to take, right or wrong, but this is something to do with South Place Ethical Society.
Yeah, right.
So we go to various meetings as executive, and the accusations get wilder and wilder as you start duplicating all these ridiculous accusations all over the place.
Got some memos flitter around like bats at twilight.
That's right, isn't it? So, one meeting, she suddenly rushed out with a whole series of unquestionably libelous statements.
This is Barbara Snaker?
Yeah. And everyone was quite amazed. I mean, instead of... I mean, as I say, there are perfectly legitimate questions to ask about it, for Christ's sake, you know, we're bloody minutes, and, you know, your bloody secretary's office looks like a tip, you know. This is, I think, a perfectly fair... But she went on all these bizarre accusations, too, and I'm, first of all, they're none of our bloody business. I mean, if he was carrying... If he was a raving transvestite homosexual, so, but frankly, it's none of the business of society, except insofar as it affects the running of the society, am I right?
I imagine so, yeah.
It's irrelevant.
Yeah.
So she dragged in all this about what he was allegedly doing to his wife, and that he was allegedly doing this and such. And at one meeting, when all this thing was all been going around, I said, I thought it was rather dangerous thing to start making hard accusations without any solid evidence. And then she, the accusations got wilder and wilder, and she started, and how Nicholas Hyman got hold of it, was not amused. And then, to cut a very long story short, the other members of the executive meeting were unhappy about him for different reasons, which in my opinion are perfectly legitimate reasons.
Right.
That he wasn't doing his bloody job.
Was he a good editor? He was quite proud of the newsletter.
Yes, I thought he was quite a good editor. Yeah. I think he was,
Did he select the speakers or anything like that?
Yes, and I think he was quite imaginative. But he wasn't terribly politically efficient at the best. Well, I had these bills. Then it's to do blood pressure.
Can they work?
Yes. It's not their habit, it's just to keep it under wraps. But anyhow.
If you want to lose weight, the trick is to switch to high bulk to calorie ratio.
Pardon?
If you want to lose weight, the trick is to switch to high bulk to calorie ratio foods.
Such as what?
Okay, well, there's a whole lot of things, stuff without fat in, you know, potatoes aren't chipped, and muesli, stuff like that. You know, a lot of fruit.
I do.
That's the proper muesli, you know, the muesli that's sold is a kind of fake, really.
Is it?
Well, in a sense, the original Swiss recipe, Dr. Birker, Swiss bloke, the original formulations have lots of chopped up fruit, just sprinkled with a bit of oats.
Yeah, right? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's true. Bit of,
yeah, I'm sure.
Because you can't sell that, you can't really package chopped up fruit, can you? So the stuff they package is really just a sort of topping, you know?
Oh, yeah, so it's not real genuine stuff.
No, it's only part of the component. It's because for packaging reasons. Yeah. It's like saying that most yoghurt, stuff called yoghurt, it's not really yoghurt, is it?
What is it?
Well, they get starch.
Skim milk with colour.
Yeah, skim milk with starch and sugar. But I mean, proper yoghurt should be full of Lactobacillus bulgaricus, shouldn't it? It should have a powerful aroma.
I just finished this silly story, you know, so...
Sorry, yeah.
And cut a long story short, eventually they de facto removed him by coming to an arrangement with him and saying that... you know, that because he had mutually agreed to resign and all that too. And who think that was the end of the matter? She continues to spread these accusations and then claims the executive committee is working with Nicholas Hyman, and we can really observe. And finally, Nicholas Hyman was pushed to the point of taking an action against her. Asking to stop repeating these libels, which I think is perfectly reasonable. Then at the last meeting, which I was at, she said that I have incited Nicholas Hyman to take the libel act. I said, how do you know? Who told you that? She said, your conversation has been tape recorded.
Oh.
So apparently, the wife has got a tape recorder in Nicholas Hyman's house. Tape recording all the messages.
Phone machine, you
know. Yeah, well, that's it. Well, in fact, it's not true. What she may have heard me saying, and I immediately contradicted, I said, I didn't say that, even if you haven't. I said, all I said is, if you feel that strongly, then you should take label action. You know, I didn't say, I wasn't encouraging him to. I said, if you feel strongly, if I accuse you of being a murderer and a criminal, that you may feel sufficiently strong that take action, wouldn't you? Well, you might. Well, you might just...
It's expensive, isn't it?
Thank you. Right. Anyhow, so the whole thing is so bloody stupid, and she will not withdraw.
That sounds rather absurd. Actually, I did tell her rather carelessly that she didn't know what she was talking about AIDS. She looked really pissed off.
Mm.
And she adopts the current view on AIDS.
Well, I think she's a sort of Jekyll and Hyde. Not Jekyll and Hyde, there was a whole part of it that's totally irrational.
Well, maybe, actually.
And she's done me no harm to me. I mean, I've got nothing personal against her. I just feel that she's a bit dotty.
There was something about the development plans, wasn't there? They were, I mean, they have rebuilt around the back, haven't they, or something? They took over a bit around the back.
Yeah.
Deal going on there.
But she accused Nicholas Hyman of getting a percentage of it. I mean, on the basis of no evidence, whatever.
Is he related? There was a property developer called Hyman, wasn't there?
Well, that may have been probably where they're connecting them. Anyhow, that's a silly story about the smoker.
Shame. Yeah. Actually, I can notice he's very guarded about other anti-Catholics. You know, there's a chap McCabe who used to be at the...
Oh, yes, I knew him.
You knew him?
Joseph McCabe, in fact, he was a friend of Frank Ridley. A
very interesting chap. He wrote lots of books.
Fascinating.
I mean, he's been more or less sort of suppressed or ignored, hasn't he? I mean, you very rarely hear about him now.
Mm.
I got one of his books. I actually had to photocopy it. I went to the institute in Bishopsgate. So
What is very interesting, having to be very careful what one says these days. I had no doubt that's not on it.
Chris, you want to show?
No. What I've said about smoker, is that on?
Yeah, it's all on there.
Oh.
Well, it's assuming you can actually distinguish it from the background noise, which is... I'm not sure about.
Right, well, let's get on to something serious then.
Well, should I switch it off now?
No, I mean, if you want to ask some serious questions.
I'm not in any hurry, I'm interested in McCabe, because
he's
mentioned by H.G. Wells, isn't he? I mean, Wells was a fan of McCabe.
Yes, well, I used to meet him with Frank Ridley in the British Library, British Museum, I mean. He was an old friend of Frank, and he was one of the really intelligent critics of the church, because his criticism was based on experience from within.
Yeah, and also the history of it, he knew it all. Mm.
And it wasn't sort of hysterical, it was actually an objective evaluation. If I may say, it's a slightly more stronger basis than Barbara Smoker.
Oh, sure. I mean, the point I was making was that I mentioned him to her, and she was rather dismissive. All she said was, she knew him, he was quite old and cranky and didn't say, you know.
Coming from her, that's funny.
Well, I mean, the point is she kind of, this is a very eminent critic.
He's a great, and she's a remarkable man.
Well, right. And she sort of underplays him. Mm. So, I mean, I took it from that she's got a vested interest in...
Him being the only.
Well, yeah, exactly.
So what else do you want to know?
What can you tell about McCabe?
Well, so all I can say is I met him and in the company of Ridley, and I read many of his books in the early 50s in the British Library. You see, that left a considerable impression on me. That it was a considered criticism of the church based on experience from within, scholarship. And he's well before his time, because when eventually the Roman Catholic Church has its 20th Congress, as I've always predicted, as the Conservative Party is about to, as I will explain in a moment, many of the people who were critical of the church from within at the Curacy will eventually be rehabilitated.
Into the church?
Well, not into the church. I think the church will be different from what it is. That's what I'm trying to say. They will accept that.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, for example, there's been attempts at trying to get the Pope, and he won't, this Pope would never do it, admit that they were responsible in a way for the Reformation.
Oh, this thing about Galileo as well.
Yeah. So I believe that I would say it's highly likely we would imagine the church in the next century. I'm just applying to all religions, by the way. Sure. I would predict that all religions in the world, in different forms and shapes, will be re-evaluating their past despite themselves. And people of the calibre in the church of Joseph McCabe will be not quite rehabilitated, they'll say he played a role in us coming to terms, if you like, with some of the malpractices they will probably eventually admit of the church. I mean, I don't think any Catholic even today would publicly support the Inquisition, would they?
There's an interesting TV programme about 6 months ago, which in effect said it wasn't as bad as it was cracked up to be. You
know, no, they didn't burn you alive, just half alive.
Well, I maintain that's quite a long programme. I made quite detailed notes on it. Mm. It's very difficult to tell what truth is, isn't it? And McCabe said that, you know, the Vatican decided to open his archive, but they took out all the ones on the Inquisition.
No, is that right?
That's what he said that's in the history of the popes. Mm. But this thing, this TV programme said that it had all these people, they're all sort of Spaniards from the University of Further Truth at Salamanca, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there's a few Americans, but they're all Catholics, and they had some
poo-poo it.
Well, yeah, they had this archive, which was supposed to be the sort of complete records of the
Inquisition.
And it said that, well, yeah, that I can't remember the actual details, but it just made out it wasn't as bad as they people said that it was part of the, they call it the Black Legend. The Spanish have got this phrase in Spanish, the Black Legend, which is that, you know, that all the Spaniards are all cruel and horrible and undemocratic.
It's not true.
Well, they say it's not true. But I don't know if the American Indians will disagree.
Well, in my opinion, probably it's even worse than we've been told. I mean, the story of what happened in Australia, the Aborigines, and the complete massacre of all the Aboriginal Tasmanians, can't be exaggerated, if anything, understated. And as you say, the American Indians, and worse still, I should think, the Spanish conquest of the Americas.
Well, the South American ones, yeah.
Yes, was certainly equally Inquisition ferocity, if not greater.
If you're interested, I'll get my notes. I made notes on that TV programme. Mm. I can print them out if you're interested.
Yeah.
My computer.
All right. I'll go on to the next question.
Well, I've got a whole lot. Okay, some of these are... First of all, can I ask you about what you said about Revelations and Atlantis? I know it's a bit kind of marginal, but...
Well, I spoke on Atlantis.
Yeah, and you spoke on the Book of Revelations.
No, well, that was arguing.
Oh, right.
That the great interest people have in Atlantis, the Book of Revelation, Nostradamus, and films about Jurassic Park.
Dinosaurs, yeah.
Yes, they're all part of a deep subculture connected with synths around impending world doom. And that's how it's linked with the Revelation.
So Atlantis, people have been talking about Atlantis since throughout the whole century.
Yes, I know, I'm not disputing that, I'm merely saying that there is an acceleration of interest because Atlantis is based on the idea of the end of the world.
I suppose it's true, now you mention it. I mean,
the psychological, the subcultural psychology, if you see what I'm trying to get at.
I don't see exactly what I mean. It hadn't occurred to me, really, if you think about it. Well, from my point of view, it's kind of underplayed. You don't hear much talk about the next millennium. Most thing I've heard talk about is whether it's 2000 or 2001, you know, January the 1st is the start of it.
Did you know in the year 1000 AD there was tremendous commotion in the world? They talk literally in the world.
No, I think there's less now than there was then, that's the point I was making. Despite the...
We don't know yet. Looking at what's happening in the Conservative Party, we have certainly got a bit of an apocalypse.
Did you know that in 1999, there's going to be a total eclipse of the sun in Cornwall?
I didn't know that.
I remember when I was about three, I found this book on astronomy, and my dad, you know, this was when I was doing
course. 1999?
Yeah, I always remember that. I always remember thinking, you know, they could predict
what
eclipses.
Month?
I think it's about March or April or something. Mm. It's in Cornwall. I was assuming the sun there. Yeah, so there's no cloud.
There's also, was it last year, there was supposed to be some... Jupiter and the Earth, there was some curious correspondence, and I thought it was highly significant.
Was it opposition or something?
Yes, that's right.
Oh, no, you don't... You might mean there was a comet that fell into it, wasn't there?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, and they thought that...
Although it fell right, it was around the other side, wasn't it? Funny thing.
But nothing happened.
Well, nothing visible from Earth, no.
Yeah, it's true, so we don't know what happened.
think there was a big hole made in Jupiter. I think when Jupiter spun round, you know, they looked at it sort of 8 hours later or something.
Mm.
There was a kind of hole in the...
No,
anyway, so that was the thing about Revelation of Atlantis. You weren't doing... I thought as a geologist, maybe you'd... You know, there's this theory that if you look off the Scilly Isles and so on, there are lots of megalithic monuments.
Now, I'm back to this point. Curiously now, the concept of a geological Atlantis is not as absurd as people might imagine. Because, in fact, Mid-Atlantic Ridge is a sort of a tiny fragment of the original locked-in American and African continents. And there's no doubt that it follows the contour of the two.
So
it seems to me highly likely that there was bits of land mass, and that as the two continents separated, there may have been one or two convulsions, and certain parts of that mid part of the original fused continent might have gone down.
Yeah, I was thinking we were stuff a bit nearer. You know, like this idea of Lioness.
Yes, well, I've read books. Yeah, well, it could be. There could be a number of Atlantis. As a continent shift, there could be one in the Mediterranean. I mean, the idea was one around, believe, would be around the Crete.
Round it, Crete.
Crete. Yeah,
because those islands are sunk. Sure. Is Atlantis named after? Is the Atlantic named after Atlantis?
Yes.
So
what I'm really trying to say to
And if you look on Ptolemy or something,
it's not as absurd as people imagine.
Sure. If you look at in something like Ptolemy, the very early maps, does that have anything corresponding to Atlantis on it?
No.
Right. So the Atlantic was named.
No, but you see what I'm trying to say is that.
Yeah, I'm not.
General thesis, if that's the right word, is that I do not accept the view that the 500 people say they've seen a flying saucer.
There must be some truth in it.
No, I didn't. I said there could be.
Yeah, right. Yes, I think it's probably. Yes, I agree.
And that they may have misunderstood what they seen is a totally different matter. But that there was something seen, or could have been something seen, seems statistically highly likely, if misunderstood.
Yeah.
Right? Now, the theory that people are all engaged in conscious fabrication is, in my opinion, simplistic.
Mm.
It's perfectly true people want to believe things and will see things that aren't there.
Okay.
We can't explain all the events which are off the beaten track or out of sync, if you like, with what we understand, as simply figments of the imagination.
No.
And I can give many examples. I talk on the Loch Ness Monster, I believe.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
I did.
Did you establish that was a fraud?
No. The whole problem about flying saucers and monsters and so on is the use of words. If you put the proposition, is there a monster in Loch Ness? I think it's a very silly proposition. Mm. If you put the proposition, is it possible there are some unidentified marine creatures or substances or something? But I think it's a perfectly reasonable question to ask, isn't it?
Yeah.
The reason you put the word monster, you completely confuse the issue. The same with, are the flying saucers? I think it's a really silly question. Far more sensible, are the unidentified aerial phenomenon? To which I think it is possible that there are.
Mm.
And a perfectly rational person can react quite positively to a statement like that.
Yeah.
And then you have to analyse and say, looking at the various possibilities, is it possible that out of the 100,000, whatever it is, things that have been seen as sources or whatever they may be, 1% are literally phenomena that we don't quite grasp? That's what I'm really saying. That's a perfectly rational, I think.
Did you sort of go through bibliographies, or did you look up bibliographies of Atlantis, for example?
I did.
Right.
And it's a bit like when I gave a lecture on Nostradamus as fact, fiction, a hell of a lot of hype.
Yeah.
Well, you've got to separate all the different elements.
Those are all recent public library books, aren't they?
Yeah. The Nostradamus ones.
Yeah.
No. Tremendous explosion of Nostradamus.
I wonder if you've done anything more, if you've borrowed a bit further back, for example, the Atlantis.
They did at the time, but I gave the lecture about 3 years ago.
Right.
It hadn't been published. I haven't written it out.
Did you check up, you know, there's stuff about Hister? I mean, presumably, if you've got the original...
Well, definitely there is a Hister.
Yeah, but the original verse, you could see from it whether it's a name or whether it's the name of a river.
Could be. Yeah, I mean, that's an example. However, one still has to be...
Fair enough, yeah.
Has to be, shall we say, and... What I was trying to say was, although I accept that, as you gather what I was generally saying, that 90%, I don't know, whatever percent you like, of Nostradamus can be dismissed as so vague and capable of interpretation, misinterpretation, that it convinces no serious scientific person or historian. However, one must admit there are one or two predictions which unquestionably are very close to the mark and are very accurate descriptions of what happened later. Right. It's difficult to explain away, that's what I'm saying.
What did you do about the Book of Revelations? The Book of Revelations. Did you read it in the original or anything?
Oh, it was written in Greek.
Greek. Yeah. So you didn't read it in Greek? You might know Greek for a while,
yeah? No, I don't. I know Hebrew.
I thought perhaps you might have,
I'll tell you my explanation of the Book of Revelations.
Okay.
Nah. I believe, have you read Engels on the Apocalypse?
No.
But Marx and Engels wrote some very interesting books on the Bible. They're based on Bauer's criticism of the Bible.
They were jointly written.
Marx and Engels wrote articles on the origins of Christianity, which were actually not terribly original. They were picked up from Bauer and the then view of that.
They wrote them in English, they were conduits from Germany.
One of the interesting comments these Engels makes is that he said the Book of Revelation, which appears to be the most obscure book of the New Testament, in fact it's the clearest, because in this ferocious imagery, he said, you have actually a description of what's actually going on. In other words, he was arguing this terribly colossal heavenly clashes, etc., with a description of the fighting with the Romans on the ground. In other words, you described the heavens were shorthand called the battles on earth, the wicked forces, etc., which I think is a perfectly reasonable explanation. Because you could feel the hatred of the Romans in it. You could almost feel it.
Yeah.
Hatred. Now,
why didn't it mention Romans in there?
It uses the word Babylonians.
But does it? Why?
Because woe is Babylon. Because the Babylonians were the great enemy of the Jews.
Oh, right.
Now, I will tell you something which is original about the Book of Revelation. Let us deal with two propositions. Let's make a statement about all the books of the Bible. It is reasonable to say that none of the prophets or books of Moses, etc., all the prophets believed that they were, when they had their visions or whatever they were having, the scribes were taking that, never believed that what they were doing was the beginnings of a contribution to a massive book called the Bible. Am I right? It's reasonable to assume that.
Exactly.
They're all doing their thing. They had their revelation, whatever it was, wrote it down, but it would never have occurred to them that Jeremiah and Isaiah said, that some editor was trying to put them all together.
Seemed to have
them
the collected works.
No, it would not have occurred to them. Am I right? I think even most Christian Jews would admit that. They were doing their thing for a particular purpose at a particular time.
Right.
And they're all edited and collected for a generic, sort of collective purpose by the rabbis and the Christian church in the 3rd century, right? Now, so they're all doing their thing. Now, most of the... Let's jump to the New Testament, so-called. Until 134 AD, the word New Testament had never been uttered. Did you know that? 134 AD, the word New Testament.
I imagine that's correct, yeah.
Which means there are all sorts of gospels and letters and epistles all drifting around, but no one had put them together. And using exactly the same principle, whoever wrote the Gospel of John, whoever wrote the Gospel of Matthew, etc., thought they were doing an account of the life of Jesus as they saw it. and experience it. Right? Yeah. That's all embroidered. It doesn't really matter.
The studio was written by them at all.
It doesn't matter. When I'm saying whoever, I didn't say Matthew wrote it. I'm saying whoever wrote the Gospel, or what was called the Gospel of Matthew, thought they would. They thought this was a one-off.
That's likely. It's not certain, is it? Because they might have been deliberately writing different views of the same thing. It might have been consciously planned.
Highly unlikely.
Well, anyway, I take your point, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's highly unlikely. It's true that it appears that one or two of the Gospels pinch from each other, but each was trying to do his thing. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, presumably, yeah.
Or give his perception of what happened.
Do you think it was jotted down? Or do you know about the mechanics of these things? Would they have a scribe to
probably
scribble?
Probably a scribe.
So he'd dictate it to a scribbler. A bit like Muhammad, in fact.
Yeah, I'm sure that's... Now, all is clever. So all is clear, but it's obvious why the Gospels are written. It's equally obvious why Paul, or whoever it was who's called Paul, wrote the epistles. He had these little groups of Judeo-Christian communities and they wanted letters of encouragement.
So he wrote them, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think there's any mystery about that. So eventually around these things all floating around, and as the church was trying to set itself up, it began to raise the status of each of these Gospels until it becomes
demote others as well.
That's right, create a corpus of literature which represented the foundations of the faith. All right.
Yeah,
now,
sounds right.
All is very clear. Until we come to the Book of Revelation, no one has ever asked the question, why was it written?
Why was it included, yeah.
Ah, no, both. Why was it written? That's a really important question, because it was clearly written before the word New Testament had ever been heard of. So the question, it doesn't matter who wrote the damn thing. The question is, it says it's supposed to be a revolution of Jesus Christ to experience by this visionary John the Divine. But the question no one's really asked is, why was it written?
Yeah.
Now, one thing we know, the date of its writing could be any time from, or started from just before 70 AD, the fall of Jerusalem. It couldn't have been later than 134 AD, because we know that the word New Testament appears.
Mm.
So in other words, the compilation of books was in the process of being assembled.
Right.
The beginnings of the outlines of what we now call New Testament. So it was somewhere between the extreme limits of 16-134 AD,
mm-hmm.
and that's before any concept of the New Testament. So we're still left with the question, why was it written? I think the clue to it, frankly, is that if you read it carefully, it's a sense of impending doom and destruction. Literally, it's an end of the world scenario. There's no question about that. No one would honestly dispute that. Of course, except that Christians say that it's 2,000 years, you know, it's in a distant future, and I think it was written, you know, doomsday now, not later. Now, in my opinion, the author didn't perceive himself as writing a book that ended up in the end of the New Testament. It was the last book of the Old Testament. Conclusion. The final chapter, the final denouement, the Armageddon of the Old Testament. But it was nothing to do with the New Testament. He thought the prophecies of Daniel were being fulfilled in...
Well, with the Romans.
Yeah, with the collapse of the Romans and all the rest of it. Now, I have evidence for it, but it's not theory.
The Roman Empire was not collapsing then, was it?
Pardon? No, he was predicting their collapse.
Oh, that's what you mean, right.
Yeah, okay. This is all vision stuff.
Yeah, right.
Now, what is interesting is that if you read the Book of Revelation, it's a story about the fall of Babylon, right? Now, woe is Babylon, woe is Babylon, and the beast and all the rest. It's quite obvious. The Babylon is Rome. Now, what is the connection? The author was trying to reconstruct the events that were happening in his time and relate it to a previous period
where Babylon fell, the Empire fell.
Yeah, equals, you know, Rome, Babylon. Now, the question is, who brought about the fall of Babylon?
Yes.
The answer is the Persians. They brought the Babylon. So who were the contemporary Persians of the Babylonian? And what is interesting, if you look at the history, the remnants, there was actually the after the collapse of the Persian Empire, as you know, the Seleucids, you know, the what's called the Greeks took over, and then it split into various sub-kingdoms. But eventually, oddly enough, a Persian version, a Neo-Persian kingdom arose, which was attacking the Romans from on the eastern flank. They call the Parthians.
Parthians. They're Persians, yeah.
Yeah, the Parthian arena. Sort of. So what his vision was, that the Parthians were attacking the Romans, and they were about to bring about their downfall. Now, interesting, the Parthians used to wear horses, we used to ride on horses with arrows, and you see from Revelation, you get that feeling of masses of horses charging around.
The strong cavalry.
That's right, attacking the Romans from the east, on the eastern flank. Now, we then go on to the very interesting question, it's an intrigue for a long time. If you read the Revelation, you find the Jesus of Revelation is very different from the Gospels. So different, you wonder if it's the same person.
No, in fact, it isn't.
Thank you. That's right, it isn't. And the first thing you notice about it is that the Jesus of, has no history. Mm. He's a person up there in heaven, throwing these thunderbolts down into the earth. But he has no history. He doesn't mention his history or life, etc. And here he is throwing all these thunderbolts. So therefore, the question is, who was this Jesus? Now, I thought very carefully about this. And I think the two things together, and it occurred to me, it says, this is a revelation of Jesus Christ. And it uses the word Kyrios, which means Lord. Now, do you know the title of the king of the Persians?
Oh.
Cyrus. Which is the Greek version of Kyrios.
That's which means, yes, like Khan and Caesar, it's kind of been assassinated.
So it is a heavenly Cyrus bringing about the downfall. There's nothing new, bloody Jesus.
Because, of course, Christ is a translation. It means, a lot of people think it's a surname, don't they?
Yes, it just means anointed.
That's
it. It's not a name.
It's like Chrysalis, it doesn't mean golden or something.
It just means anointed. It means,
I think it's got a double sort of meaning of, like Chrysalis, it means golden as well. It means, like the Buddha, was the light
maybe
of Asia. It's
maybe.
It's an illumination.
You might be right on that. But what I'm saying, it's not the name of a person.
That's a good point, actually, because you do get, like these Khans, Cohen is supposed to be from Khan. They call it, according to Arthur Kersler.
Yeah, oh, yeah, so it's
in the Khazars.
Yeah, the theory that they're the Khazars. Yeah. You know,
it's quite ingenious. Now, Khans and Cohens, just like Caesar and Tsar and all the rest of it.
Now, is there any evidence of this theory? Now, what is very interesting is, I think the early church sensed there was something wrong there, and it had a lot of, you know, had a great difficulty in getting into the canon of the New Testament. Because I think they half sense this is not right. It
doesn't belong.
It doesn't belong. Well, it doesn't belong. Because the Jesus of the Revelation is the exact opposite of the image. You know, the ferocious fellow throwing thunderbolts.
Right.
Forgiveness and all the rest of it all disappears.
So why did they get in?
What?
Why did they put it in then?
Because I think it was popular appeal. Because it had a powerful, what's the word? It had a resonance with the new, you know,
that's your brother uses that word as well. He says that Marx still has resonance, whereas Gibbon doesn't.
Well, I think that's a good one. That's agree with him. That's a good one.
Gibbon is still.
That's rather boring.
This is boring. Well, yeah. I suppose this one.
Yeah. So now, what I'm reading about, now, so if my theory is correct, and I'm pretty sure it's correct, the fact I've got further separate evidence on that, there's a famous Roman Catholic who Ridley drew my attention. I've got it at home. I xeroxed it. He wrote a book about 38, so you can get it in the British Library, called Apocalypse. And he says, Revelation has nothing to do with Jesus. It is in fact the account of the Bar Kokhba revolt against the Romans, because he uses the word I am the morning star, and the morning star is Bar Kokhba. Now, there are problems about the chronology, and he's actually rewritten the Apocalypse minus the Christological interpretation.
Why should it be written in Greek anyway?
Done?
Why should it be written in Greek?
Why should it have been written? Well, there may have been an original Aramaic original.
Yeah, hasn't been,
we don't, I mean, I don't know, I don't. But it, apparently it is possible from the Greek to read back into the Aramaic because there's certain structures, I believe, that relate to it.
Even the translation is a bit crude.
I don't know if it's ever been done.
It's difficult to do, isn't it? Do you take the view that Jews spoke Aramaic then?
I'm sure it's true. Mm. It was the vernacular.
Yeah. So what happened about Hebrew? But Hebrew was used as a sacred language.
Yes, mate, yes. I think it probably may have been a more general language, but Aramaic was the general.
Is it a bit analogous to English, Jews in England, is it?
Pardon?
A bit analogous to Jews in England.
Jews in England?
No, because they speak English as a general
language. Oh, I see what you mean. Mm. Although just Aramaic and Hebrew are related to each other, not that far apart.
They use the same alphabet, don't they?
Yeah.
I think they do, anyway. Yeah.
So we dealt with Revelation.
Right. Have you heard of Elaine Pagels? Does that ring a bell?
Well, I've read her books. I'd like to meet Elaine Pagels. Of course I have.
Gnostic
religious. I'm into Gnostic. I've read all of them.
Oh.
I think it's a fascinating subject. I think it's opened a completely new chapter on the history of Christianity in that. Our understanding of how to wrote. It clearly establishes, in my opinion, that the Orthodox view that we have is only a half view. There was another Gnostic view of Christianity which was suppressed.
It's not known about.
That's right. And the question is why? I think she exaggerates a bit, but I do think a suggestion that the Gnostic trend was, dare I use it, more libertarian, more was less rigid, more speculative than the what became the official version. And I'm certain that she's correct in saying the original church women played a far bigger role, and the Catholic Church made man dominant.
Well, I mean, the whole word church changes meaning. It originally just meant a little clinical group.
That's right, yeah. And what is a very interesting point, I have some of my good Christian friends point out, I'm very interested, very few people know the answer to this question. I said, question, how many books of the Old Testament are named after a woman?
Good question.
Come?
Can't think of any of them.
Three.
Three are?
Esther, Ruth, and probably Song of Solomon.
There are also a few apocryphal ones, aren't there?
Yes, there's a word from Susanna.
Susanna or something.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Judith. Right, so my answer to the first question, the Old Testament and the apocryphal ones. How many books of the New Testament are named after a woman? Do you know the answer to that?
Sounds like zero, I think.
Direct hit, not a single one. Now, you may think that's not significant, but I think it's highly significant. It seems to suggest that the early church, I'm not saying that in the Jewish religion women elevated very far from it. What I'm trying to say is that whatever the status of women were in Judaism as reflected in the Old Testament's writings was certainly better than when the New Testament over, where the woman is completely excluded.
What do you think of this idea that I came across in one of the ethical records that Christianity was a sort of birth control device, didn't it? Because populations were burgeoning.
No, I haven't heard that. So, I think Gnosis is extremely interesting because, you see, when you think of it, what they were really arguing was this horrible Old Testament God, vengeful, barbarous and all the rest of it, could not be the true God. Therefore, Marcion in 134 AD, this is one of the great critical periods of the Reformation Christianity, proclaimed a New Testament not as the completion of the Old Testament, but as its rejection. And he said, the Jewish God is dead, Jesus comes forward as a true God. In other words, Jesus was the rejection of the Old Testament, not the conclusion. So in other words, there's some element of dualism in another. The conflict between this dark Jarvis God, the Demiurge, the Creator, who's responsible.
Would that also be useful if you're not Jewish and you become a Christian convert? Presumably that's hopeful to be.
To make the split even bigger.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Is this anything to do with the Dead Sea Scrolls? How's that fit in?
Because no, I think the Dead Sea Scrolls seems to me a game.
Did you read the book about them? About the, it's called the Desi's Rose and the scandal or something?
Yeah, well, I think there's, what was the right word? Let's put it on. I think we should be very careful about conspiracy theories, or I think about conspiracies. And
there are laws on conspiracy, aren't there?
Pardon?
There are laws about conspiracies.
Yes.
So presumably...
No, what I'm saying is I think that, shall I put it this way, the Roman Catholic Church, I'm sure, was very, very concerned that the publication of these manuscripts would clearly show that some of the doctrines of the New Testament were not original. And therefore, the uniqueness of Christianity was being challenged.
Yeah, right.
No, I think that disturbed them. And they wanted to place the Dead Sea Scrolls in a Christian context. They weren't prepared to accept that, in fact, it could have predated Christianity and anticipated it,
right,
which would have destroyed the uniqueness of Christianity. And therefore, it could be that they were hurrying, shall we put it that way?
It's been years later. They must have, I suspect they might have destroyed some as well, like a kind of
concept. Yeah, well, that's also possible.
Yes, well, that's made it quite likely, really. I think eventually there was a kind of political struggle, wasn't there? And the wife of one of these people finally decided that they could, anybody could, you know, they
eventually probably, yes, yes. But that was, but even when it's all published, the theory of conspiracy I find overstated, you know, over a bit exaggerated. So I say that the church only wanted the scroll, only wanted to publish those parts of the scrolls that established their view that it was simply a very...
So it's also about the giver of wisdom, wasn't it, or something?
Yes, so that's a, yeah, no, it's a dream. Yeah, but there's teacher righteousness.
Oh, yes.
Teacher righteousness, yeah. But it could be, what it seems to be is that it anticipates the Christian...
Well, the idea is, I mean, all these people throughout the whole of the century going on about how, well, as soon as anthropology was invented, they found all these resurrection myths.
Right, so deal with that one. What's the next one?
This is what your brother was talking about, the change of vocabulary in the church.
The change of what?
The vocabulary, he made all the meaning of words, he maintained a word like legend, for example.
Yeah, I know that, yeah. Well, yeah. I think there's something what my brother says, but my comment on that is that he's not saying anything terribly original in that.
Yeah.
Language is changing all the time, and I give you some examples.
Yeah,
it's too obvious to state it. Let me give you a simple example. In the last few decades, for example, the word gay has changed its meaning. There's no question about it. If I said to you gay in 1950, you would say jolly. It has actually changed its meaning.
Well, it has a related meaning. Apparently it used to mean prostitute in about 1890 or something.
Yeah, but I mean, that's just another... Clever and cunning, and crafty. Now, crafty originally meant good at your craft, didn't it? Yeah. Cunning meant literally your cunning carver. It didn't have no overtone. Today it has a negative.
Particularly, I think in America it's slightly different. America, I think they use cunning to talk about like interior decoration.
Yeah. Yes, that may be. I didn't know that. But let me give you the word clever itself today has already changed its meaning. Because as someone said, someone's clever. There's an innuendo, there's a sort of an undercurrent. Clever. He's clever, you know.
Just devious, you mean?
Yeah, it's already. Now, if in our own language, in our own lifetime, we've seen words change, when Harold says about legend and this, well, I mean, to be honest, it's obvious.
Yeah, right.
I mean, every word.
I think it was a deliberate. Yeah, that people they read up stories of the saints, and they were more critical. People were inclined to be more critical. So the meaning changed from legend, meaning just make you read, to to mean like legendary or myth. That's another example.
Well, I think
I can't quite remember what his example was. That's not a very good example.
Yes. Well, as I say, well, I'm saying there may be some truth, but I'm a bit dubious about
conspiracy. Know it.
Yes, conspiracy. Well, right.
Crucifixion, he maintains the fact that the crucifixion isn't described in the Bible.
Oh, yeah, I know about it, yes.
A good point, I think. Yeah, he thinks
but
that the point is they used to impale them, like, gladly impale them.
Well, they did, I'm sure they did.
There's a Babylonian that thinks that.
Yes, I'm sure that's true, because in the Book of Esther, Haman was impaled, no doubt about it. And the Romans took over that method of execution.
The trees you have a... Oh.
Yes, and yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Stick on top of
that's right. Yes, it's pretty horrible.
Pull them down a bit.
That's right. It's pretty horrible. But the image of the crucifixion, I think there's a confusion because confusion is the identification of the cross is I am the beginning and the end. The cross is I am Alpha, Gamma, and the last letters is a cross.
Again, Alpha, Alpha,
I'm sorry, Alpha,
Omega. Neither of them look anything like a cross.
But the... there's one of the letters has got the cross on it. It's got
Chi.
What?
The Chi.
Yes, that's okay. But it's used. It's used.
Yeah, I take your point too.
The shape was connected with... and also they said that they had a sign on their head. And it's almost certainly a cross. But
I'm sure that symbol existed before Christianity, didn't it?
Yes.
Like the circle, and the Celts had the circle.
Yes, I know, yes. Right.
I can ask about... Saracens and Islam.
Yes, so what about?
Well, I met a chap who's, told me that he reckoned that all the stuff attributed to the Arabs about preserving Greek words. It was really the Saracens and the Arabs who were warlike. Recognise the sense of having a sort of educated class looking at it. Pretty sad or something like that.
Could be.
Is that a well-known? Oh, I thought
no.
What's your view of Kilaire Bella? What's your view about him?
I've read him years and years ago. He was extremely reactionary. Because distributors move.
He gave Catholic view in England, I think, when it was unusual. It's hard to find out what Catholic school.
He seems to have a great early, great Catholic apologists. What I think is very interesting today is we're going through a very interesting period in the history of the church here. I haven't any doubt whatever that the Roman Catholic Church is engaged in a determined effort to win back England to Rome.
Yeah, I think Bellot may have thought he was the Saint Bellot.
Yeah. And I haven't any doubt that there's a concerted effort starting with the aristocracy. It's interesting, they're not going for the working class people, they're going for influential people in the aristocracy. And in the monarchy. Well, I mean, that's where they're from. Work from above downwards. And I think Bellot was one of the people in the Bertha Norton who were trying to encourage a repetition of the great High Church desertion under Cardinal Newman before the Vatican I.
He did make a few assertions, for example, that the hue and cry, the legal thing about hue and cry, was abolished because of Jewish influence. That's what Belloc said. I presume what he meant was that originally if there was a theft or something, everybody would say, stop thief, and they would all run after them. There was some kind of obligation to joint action. If something happened in the street market or something.
I haven't heard that.
I wonder if there's any...
No, I haven't heard that.
Did you show your brother about things like trooping the colour in national anthems? Well, Harold said that he looked into the ceremony of trooping the colour.
Oh yeah, what did he say about that?
He just said it was a bit old rag. They should walk around it.
Well, I think it was really to ask somebody about the... I must admit I can't understand why people are so obsessed about football and cricket.
Yeah.
And I spoke to somebody who's a sports expert, and he said it's really a very primitive instinct going back to animals. It's like hunting. There's tremendous excitement, hunting, chasing, bringing things down, and it's deep in us. And sport is something that goes back to our forefathers.
the pack idea.
I also think that I always believe that civilizations are very thin veneer. We live in. We're in a jungle.
Veneer on the jungle plants.
That's right. a very thin veneer, and you just have to shape the thing, and all the bitter in all aluminium sticks. I think beautiful example is what's happening in the Conservative Party today. It's a beautiful example of a perfectly normal group of people, only normal, with clear views, faced with a crisis and going literally berserk. Engaged in self-destruction, which is, you know, unbelievable. They're totally irrational. It doesn't fit in with any...
They want to become positive.
Some?
It's not completely irrational. One who emerges as a leader, then he's a big success from his point of view.
Yes, but I mean, it's sort of, it's almost a crowd hysteria.
Actually, Harold also collected national anthems, hasn't he? He's got a collection like
that. I didn't know that.
But funny, yes, he's got one of, you know, these places like Indonesia.
Yeah.
And after that, freedom.
No, I didn't know that. I'm learning more about Rwanda every day.
Did you say one
thing? No, someone's coming along just for a few minutes.
Kabbalists. Christian Kabbalists. How come they were allowed access to the Bible at all?
To the Kabbalah. How do you mean?
I assume Kabbalists use the Bible. Permuted it. Read things into it.
I know the Kabbalah.
Oh, right, sorry, got that wrong.
Well, this Jewish Kabbalah. And what was later the Christian Kabbalah. The Jewish Kabbalah, it would appear, just as in Christianity later on, there must have been mystical trends within Judaism from the very early days. People speculating on the nature of the universe, and even Gnostic heresies of one sort or another. Now, the Kabbalists, the people who read into the straight story of the scriptures, a mystical meaning. And there's some very amazing ones called the Book of Creation, Sefer Yetzirah, which is a curious numerological book.
No, when you say the Kabbalah, you mean that's a collection of writings by Kabbalists?
No, well, it just means the received tradition sort of thing. It means it's a mystical tradition that goes back into Judaism, deep into Judaism, and it's always parallel the Orthodox. But sometimes crossing it, sometimes colliding with it.
So it's a whole parallel library of works.
Yes, but yes, that's right. Now, the key work which created a great sensation was the publication of the Zohar, which is the most famous book of the... it claims to be written by a rabbi in the second centuries, rather. It's written by a man, almost certain, named Moses de Leon in the 13th century.
In Spain?
Yes. And it purports to be various rabbis, curious names, allegedly in Palestine, but none of the names fit. It's almost like a description of Spain.
Yeah.
We're
talking to each other, you mean?
Yes.
Conversation?
Yeah. Making most incredible assertions about the text, which have no relations whatever with the text. It's a sort of bad speculation, what we might call mad speculation.
Okay, the text of the Old Testament.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's a sort of a kind of mystical commentary on the Bible,
right,
but has no relationship with the actual text.
You mean you might say like Moses used to eat snakes for breakfast or something?
That's right, something like that, yeah. Or, and there's some significance in having snakes as well.
Right.
Eating snakes.
What does Zohar mean?
Splendor. It comes from the Book of Daniel. Zohar means splendor.
Hebrew, Aramaic?
Hebrew. Zohar, splendor. Now, what happened now? Well, it's interesting. Good. When the Zohar was published, because it was published in fake Aramaic, it's not genuine Aramaic. That's how they know that it's a forgery. It's not the Aramaic of the time it claims to be, about 2nd or 3rd century. So it's a fake Aramaic. No, it doesn't. It's like somebody... Some are trying to write English poem in Chaucerian English, so they don't get at
it. It could be anachronisms or something.
That's right. It doesn't work.
Okay.
It doesn't, anyhow, the interesting point is that the Zohar was eventually translated into Latin. And the Christians got hold of it, and they saw in it a bridge to Christianity. Because there are odd references in the Zohar to, I wouldn't say a trinity, but there are one or two remarks which could be loosely interpreted as a hint about
sort of Trinitarian thing.
That's right.
Yeah.
So they began to ascribe, they did the same to the Kabbalah that the Zohar, what the Zohar had done to the Old Testament. They began to ascribe mystical significance to an absurd interpretation of the Bible. And they put an absurd interpretation of the Zohar.
Right.
And therefore you get to develop what's called the Christian Kabbalah, and they used it as a means of bringing Jews over to Christianity.
What I've got down here is how come Christian Kabbalists were allowed access to the Bible at all?
By who?
Well, I don't know, I'm not sure, you see, there's a big tradition, in, it took me years to understand actually, in Belloc, you know, you see Belloc accused actually was of being a Bible Christian. I thought that's a bizarre phrase to use, isn't it?
So what's wrong with being
Bible? Well, I read through Kevin Comey through one of their books, more obscure books, his attitude to Bible, you know, it's a big, big technical book, so naturally you need interpreters, you know?
Right. I need the church.
That's right. So and the plebos are not allowed to look at it.
It's all that's what it's all about. That's what the Reformation is all about.
It took me ages. I was in Spain until recently. It wasn't banned, wasn't it? You know, there's this thing about Borrow in Spain, George Borrow.
Oh yeah, he said the Bible. Yes, I read that years ago, yeah.
So what I'm asking is, why is it these Christian Kabbalists were allowed access to it, or were they just all bishops and things anyway?
But the answer is that the study of the Zohar became of interest to Christians during the Reformation.
Oh right, so it both dates the actual book.
Yes, that's right, yes. In other words, Reuchlin was interested, he was one of the informers. And it's the real interest in the Kabbalah on a really big scale amongst Christians started from the world of the Reformation.
Reuchlin,
a great Christian scholar.
And Erasmus,
I think it was German. Yes, I think so.
Luther, I should say. Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. There's all to do with like, the control of the way information is controlled, isn't it? Well, yeah. I think the church had control over reading and writing from an early age, didn't it?
Yeah.
Like you didn't want to.
It's a completely totalitarian system.
That's quite clever, isn't it? Well, I remember reading in one Belloc's apologetic thing that, you know, the church never enforced reading on people. They didn't want to learn to read and write then. Nobody would force them to. But they, he didn't mention this sort of footnote, but the only way they could was under the auspices of the church. Yeah. Oh, I mind that. What do you think about the Gordon riots then? These are ones that, you see, Wells had a thing about the Gordon riots. He said that...
Did he? Yes, she was.
He wrote a thing called Crux Ansata.
No, I didn't know that. No. He mentions the Gordon riots?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Either.
Well, you see, he was... He looked at the way they appear in literature. There's a Penguin book. I've got a copy of it actually.
What's it called?
It's called Crux Ansata, An Indictment of the Roman Catholic Church, written about 1944.
It would be in the British Library.
Oh, it'd be there, yeah. It's hard to get that. Hold on otherwise.
And he mentioned
Gordon Wright particularly because he was interested in popular reactions because he's a lefty. He was associated with him. So he looked at Gordon Wright because they appear in Barnaby Rudge, I think.
That's right.
And there's one or two other things. He was, what he was doing was, he was, you know, because everybody says this was a shameful episode. But his view was that possibly it wasn't. So he was
worried about
it. Yeah.
See, one my comment on Gordon Wright, I gave a talk last Thursday on the Gordon Wright. I'd been fascinated by this extraordinary character, Lord George Gordon, because the episode connected with Gordon's allegedly leaving the riots and his subsequent conversion to Judaism struck me as, put it mildly, bizarre, and I was curious to know what was the real truth. So I have read quite a lot about Lord George Gordon, but one of two things that didn't add up. First of all, I began to realise that the Gordon riots weren't riots. They were actually a failed English revolution in 1780. More people were killed. Hundreds of people were killed.
The French Revolution.
No, there were just a handful of people killed.
Well, that's what McCabe said, wasn't it?
Yes,
it's a myth about the bloody...
Yes, it was completely rubbish. And we have the myth of the French Revolution. The Gordon riots were simply a few people wandering around throwing sticks. Not true. It was a revolution. They actually sacked Newgate. It was far more serious than when they got into the Bastille. It was a handful of... Well, I think it was one madman there. I mean, there's hardly anybody there. And they released hundreds of prisoners. It was a real... And it was crushed by an army. Very confused army. Right. Now, the person who headed or alleged to have headed was Lord George Gordon, who was a head of the Protestant Alliance. Now, what is very interesting about that period, of course, is that Britain was then involved with the Americans for the War of Independence. And George III was continually recruiting more people to reinforce the army there. And a bill was introduced, the Catholic Disabilities Bill, which released some of the Catholics from some of the more repressive legislation. It wasn't out of love for the Catholics. It was in order to enable them to be recruited into the army as mercenaries to fight, as it were, the Americans. And the revolt, which took on an anti-Catholic form, was in fact a revolt against the British involved in the war against America. It was an anti-imperialist. Yeah. And also hatred of George III and William Pitt. I mean, it was about one of the most unpopular monarchies in modern British history.
Was the army made up of Hessians and things?
Yes. Okay. So I mean, it was a native army. Not a properly native army. Yeah, Catalan soldiers. It was suppressed with great violence, and Lord George Gordon was put on trial, and he was accused of being the leader. And it appears that he didn't actually lead the insurrection, if that's the right word. He was more the mouthpiece. I mean, he was addressing crowds, and the crowds did what they did.
It was like Robespierre or something.
Well, not quite. I would say he was... I don't think he'd actually reached that stage. I mean, he did tell them to seek to attack Newgate, but I think probably his speeches might have sparked on the sort of insurrection. And to cut a long story short, he was acquitted. Then we come to the other curious thing, that shortly afterwards, he appears to make contact with met a Jew in Norwich, and started getting interested. I mean, to cut a long story, he wanted to be converted to Judaism. And the chief rabbi, a kind of community, the chief rabbi, Temple Ship, I don't know, when he was approached, was distinctly, cool towards him. And as I said in my lectures, as if Ian Paisley would suddenly announce his conversion to Judaism, I can't imagine the chief rabbi rushing to embrace him. It was sort of, they wanted him like a hole in the head, you know. So he had a lot of difficulty, and eventually, in a very, through some back door, he got converted. He then...
Into mainstream Judaism?
Yes, what would appear to be.
Presumably there weren't many Jews there at Britain at the time. I was surprised there wasn't a chief rabbi.
Well, a chief rabbi here. Yeah. There's only rabbi one or two. You know, he was the senior rabbi. You know, to cut a long story short, he was then... He then made a number of libelous statements against Mariano Bonet, and he was arrested and accused of sedition, whatever, put in Newgate Prison, which had been kindly rebuilt. And he carried on his orthodox interest, and eventually he couldn't get surety, and even though he couldn't leave prison, he didn't quite believe it, and he died of typhus in prison. Now, the really interesting question, of course, to me was, you had this strange situation where the person converted to Judaism, and yet at the same time was carrying on this extreme, what to them, it didn't soften his political position at all. He probably seemed to denounce the George III, he wrote letters to the Abbe Gregoire, who was one of the Girondins of the French Revolution. In other words, he carried on his politics independently of his conversion. That's not right. Okay. Now, I don't want to go too many, it's too many complicated, too many complicated interconnected subjects. But particularly interesting to me was his connection with William Blake. Now, I found out, first of all, that William Blake had seen the Gordon riots. And if you read some of his poems, they're a description of the actual insurrection. The capturing of Newgate, which he saw as the English Bastille,
which it was.
Now, what intrigued me was that I found a engraving of William Blake which shows what looks like a rabbi looking into a vault. And under the front, under the page, it says, this is Lord George Gordon. So you say, what the hell is Lord George Gordon doing on his etching? One. And two, he's described as Los, who is one of the great mythical hero figures of Blake. Jerusalem. Yeah, Los.
Yeah, I know. There's Los. No dictionary compiled of Blake's...
How do you got it?
I'm not into Blake. I met a chap called Cadogan. He used to be at the...
Oh, I know Peter Cadogan, yeah.
But he's into Blake, isn't he? He's got a reproduction of...
Yeah, I must contact him.
Yeah, he's got a reproduction. He's also got this book, this sort of... There's only one volume, sort of encyclopedia, you know, sort of lexicon.
Oh, yes, I've got the words. Anyhow, the point is, Sol is Los. Los is Sol.
Oh, Sun. Yeah.
Sun, yeah. No. It's clear, so you read the Song of Los, and you read the Los poem, that he's clearly a great mythical figure, who's, even like in Revelation, who's taking on the forces of evil, and bringing about the discretion. But why the hell should a converted Jew become the symbol of it? That's the question that's very difficult to understand. Particularly, as if you read his poems, they're distinctly anti-Jewish. And I would say anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, I mean, because his view of Christianity was a Gnostic view, that the Old Testament was law and repression, and Jesus was love and forgiveness, all the rest of it.
A Gnostic view, is it?
Yes.
You mean that he was being unconsciously influenced by Gnostics, or just that...
That's the really... Where did he get it from?
Well, he might just mean his temperament, of course, like
possibly, but... he read Jacob Boehm, he was a great mystic.
Oh, right. And Swedenborg as well.
Yes, he's a great Swedenborg. He was critical of Sweden, but he had read to it. A lot of these curious sects around at the time. Now, my theory is that there was somebody in his circle who had Gnostic beliefs. Now, there's one person I'm getting to name, Henry Fuseli. Ever heard of Fuseli?
Fuseli, yes. It rhymes with Mercy. It's probably Fuseli is probably how it's pronounced. Mercy is pronounced...
Swiss.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's written like that, isn't it?
Yeah, that's an F-U-E-S...
Yeah, I think it could be written like that.
That it is.
Fuseli.
Correct. How do you know? Very good. Four marks.
He's quite a famous artist.
Yes, great artist.
Well, he's sort of minor, like Beardsley or something.
That's right, quite right.
Now,
the interesting thing is that he was his closest friend.
Yes.
Now, he makes a very curious remark, he calls him a Turk and Jew.
Well, that's right, he's the only friend.
Well, what the hell?
He did not make me almost spew, it was Fuseli, he wasn't the other.
Yes, but what the hell does that mean? Now, I've looked up the dictionary about, they call it Bibliography of Artists, what do they call it? Dictionary of Artists.
Yeah,
and I came across Fuseli. And he was originally a Zwinglian preacher, which is hardly connected with a Turk and Jew. Now, it brings me on to a very interesting idea I have. You see, you wouldn't know about it. There was, in the 17th century, a tremendous messianic movement around Shabbatai Tzvi. Have you heard of him?
Who?
Shabbatai Tzvi. 17th century.
Can you spell it?
S-H-A-B-E-T-A-I.
E-T-I.
Yes. Z-E-V-I. Now, he's probably the most... I'm sure you have.
I don't think I have.
One of the most remarkable messianic pretenders of all time.
Really?
He was almost successful. In the year 1660, or somewhere around there. And don't forget, that was 1666, and everyone thought the end of the world was coming, you know.
Yeah.
The beasts and all this nonsense.
Was it 666?
Yeah, it's all this nonsense. Anyhow, now, there was also the Kabbalists had some calculator about 1642, I don't know what it was, that the Messiah would come in the year 1640. Now, to cut a long story short, Shabbatai Tzvi proclaimed himself the new Messiah. It's a colossal eruption. And the community, most of the Jewish community just fell for him, just like a ton of bricks. And there were reports that the various armies were rounding, going back to Palestine. I mean, they literally thought it was happening. And it created the most colossal commotion. Anyhow, one day, you know, take hours and get the whole story. Eventually, he began to be a bit of a nuisance as far as the Sultan was concerned. He was preaching.
Okay, you mean they had a sort of crusade?
The Sultan was very concerned about what appeared to be disruptive activities, these messianic characters charging around. Because in Greece and in what we now call Turkey,
Asia Minor,
that's right, that's where this thing began. And he was arrested and brought before the Sultan, and he said, here is a turban, and here is a fire. Choose. So what did he do?
He
chose a turban.
So he became a turban.
That's it. And assumed Islam. Now, of course, this came as a colossal shock, as you can imagine, to his followers. They began, as all people, to develop all sorts of mysterious explanations. And they began to develop this is all part of the divine plan to enter Islam, put a spark of his messianic system into Islam.
But a lot of them as well.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But of course, he then started playing a double game, and eventually they locked him up even tighter. But he still continued this curious double game all the time. Now the amazing thing, you would have thought that with his death, he would all collapse. Not so. He had followers all over Europe and in Asia Minor, and to this day there are groups of people, a friend of mine met them in Izmir, still hold on to this, what is absolute crazy belief. Now,
what do they call themselves?
Well, they're called the Dunme.
Yeah.
It means, now, where the connection, what's the connection? The connection is as follows. They had this strange idea that a soul could enter the shell of another, and it's a sort of like
a science fiction film, yeah.
It's a sort of, what do we call it, reincarnation film. The soul enters another body.
It's a special word in Bernard Shaw, isn't it? Four syllables.
No, I just wonder, because this girl would be wandering around at 19. I'll recognise. So, the question is, we have this curious sect. Now, the interesting thing, when he died, it split into various sects, subsects.
Subsects, yeah.
Yeah. And then, in Poland, in about 18th century, or the end of the 18th, another fellow emerged named Jacob Frank, who said that he was the reincarnation of Chevalier.
F-R-A-N-C-K.
Yeah. Frank. The father's half Frankenstein, where it all comes from.
Really?
Yeah. Frank. Now, Jacob Frank began the same process Shabbatai Zvi. He began playing a double game, saying that we have to enter Christianity. And he said that just as the psionic soul had entered to Islam, it now had to enter Christianity. And therefore he approached the Roman Catholic Church and asked to negotiate a massive entry into the Roman Catholic Church on certain conditions. You know, that they could all keep apart, they could still not eat pork or whatever it was. But the Catholic Church said, no. You either come or you don't, you know. No compromise. Anyway, eventually they decided to convert en masse, but still carried on this double game. Now, what is the connection with George Gordon? What is interesting is that it's reported that some Turkish Jews visited Gordon in prison. And I'm pretty sure they are of this group. Mm. The question, why would they be interested in him? Because this was the proof of their theory of the transmigration of souls. The soul had gone out and has come back again. Because he was a Christian, and the soul was in him, and he'd come back to Judaism. So they saw the cycle. Now, to us, it's absolutely absurd, isn't it? To any rational person.
Yeah.
But my belief, my suspicion is that he became a cult figure of this group, and that somewhere along the line, in one of the persons in his circle may have convinced William Blake that this was in fact the great Gnostic messianic figure.
Mm.
Now, it sounds absurd at first,
yeah.
But then let's look at Henry Fuseli. It is a very curious comment to make of him, Turk and Jew, and it's possible that he is of that sect.
Were there many Jews living under Islam? Were they allowed to?
No, but they, yes, oh yes, quite a lot of Jews. And also, there were a lot of Frankist Jews,
yeah.
You know, people who followed Jacob Frank. But as I say, we'll need more research into that. But there is no question, if you read the Song of Lost in Jerusalem, it's a description of the breaking down of the prisons. All there is a description of the Gilman riots. There's no question about it. and his empathy with the structure of the Bastille, all the rest of it. And it is obvious that Gordon is the great mythical figure. And as I say, if anyone can give me a better explanation of that, I'd like to hear it.
What do you make of things like Barnaby Rudge and the...
Now Dickens had the same problem with the French Revolution as he had with the English Revolution of the Gordon Riots. Distinctly unsympathetic with it, Barnaby.
I think
you're trying to be fair to them. I think the Victorians never recovered from the shock of the French Revolution. And they still regarded it as a great thing, like the October Revolution. It should never have happened. And therefore, everything was seen through a very reactionary prism.
By everybody. There were lots of people supporting the French Revolution.
At the time, yes, but a lot of them turned against it later on. William Blake was disillusioned. They changed, but by the time Dickens in the mid last century was already reflecting the general perception, therefore his hostility to the Gordon Riots is no different from his hostility, his attitude, no different from that, from his attitude to the French Revolution. I mean, just look at the myths of the French Revolution, that's never really been out of that. The myths! Let's deal with the guillotine, for example. There was a lot of terrible people. But people don't realise it was regarded as a relatively humane thing, compared with the horrible ways that they used to kill people.
Your brother was trying to think about that, ways of killing people. No. I think it was reprinted recently when I was having to think about this American, this British chap in an American jail.
They have to catalogue. Yeah. You see, so right. The other interesting thing is that everyone talks about the figures of the people killed in the French Revolution, but they don't look at the figures before the French Revolution. There are hundreds of people have been killed right there.
Are you quoting McCabe?
No.
It's just well known.
The what?
For example, the figures. I mean, McCabe said that it was nowhere near as bad as
the
figures.
Right, the French Revolution.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not particularly quoting McCabe, but it's possible it goes back to my memory of reading it. But the other important thing about the French Revolution, it was far more radical than the French Revolution, in some respects. The most important aspect which is more funny is it changed the calendar. No other revolutionary force in the world has ever attempted to change the calendar.
The French one?
Yes, they changed the calendar.
Yes, they really changed the seasons.
It's unbelievable. I mean, that is the most...
The metric system.
Even the Bolsheviks ever tried that.
And the metric system.
Yes, I know, but I mean, that was the most revolutionary thing. Yeah. I mean, conceptually, to challenge the calendar with a whole...
Like introducing a leg day week or something.
So, I think the French Revolution is... it's been misunderstood and misrepresented, and it probably, in terms of its impact on the British left and centre, is greater than the October Revolution, because the October Revolution never really broke out of its Russian, Chinese, Eastern Europe.
They were also attacked by they came under very heavy attack. It's amazing they survived too, really.
That's true. It's amazing Stalin won the war, to be honest. So to this day, it's a miracle.
Would it not be surprising if the Russians had just given up?
Could it be?
That's pretty true. What do you think of Napoleon?
Relatively progressive, everything is relative as well, relatively progressive. The way he did it may be a bit rude. But the changes he brought out in Europe were generally quite progressive, actually.
That's certainly true from the start, isn't it? But when people talk about him, they always kind of hedge their bets. They say he started up
quite well.
Welcomed as a liberator, but he never brought much liberation at all.
Well, Haiti. The poor old, what's his name? Toussaint Louverture, was his fault. But eventually he died.
Napoleon invaded.
No, they won't let him die, he didn't intervene.
That's 666, I remember reading it. Asking the new scientists and somebody thought that might be. It was all wrong, it should be 6 cubed, 216. So bring it back with you. I've never
found that. 6 cubed? Well,
therefore what? So they've got the number wrong.
Who did?
Okay. And when he quotes 666, it should really be 216. According to this thing in the New Scientist, wouldn't I?
Just therefore what?
I don't know. Just a passing comment. We ask you about oddities about, like, for example, just in the last week, I came up with this idea that banking was illegal before the Reformation. Fair statement. Well, yeah. Banking was illegal in the Reformation.
Well, because you weren't allowed to lend, only Jews were. They used the Jews to lend money.
Is it fair to say that's the same as banking is illegal?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a correct statement.
What do I read? I read it in a book by a Swiss chap, actually.
Yeah.
Maybe Swiss up in the Swiss.
Yeah. I must admit, slightly coming back to Fuseli, I really would like to find out more about Fuseli. I haven't read it must have been a biography of Fuseli, wasn't it?
Oh, I imagine so.
Yeah. I just read an entry on him as a painter. But it would be interesting to know more about his religious belief. He was involved with occult movements too, I know that.
Oh, right, yeah. Masonry. That's what his paintings were like, weren't they?
Yeah, very...
Things with funny eyes and stuff.
Yeah.
Strange books. I'm not sure why, like... I mean, Cadogan might know about him.
Yes, I think he's seen the Telegram directory.
I've got his number. I'll phone you up and tell you if you like. Yes, he lives in Camden, in a sort of council place.
Yeah. What's he doing? He's getting on, is he?
He's getting older, yeah. I think he's doing great here. Like, he's got his interest in... He writes letters to the press occasionally. So
yeah.
Mostly lives in his flat on his own, I think.
Doing what?
I think he's married. He might be divorced.
Mm. Very strange chap. He was in the Socialist Labour League, wasn't he? The Healy Art Group.
Jerry Healy?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't make him out. He was sort of...
Have you met him?
Well, yes. I went to speak to him once. He maintained he's an anarchist. So just before the Gulf War, actually. He was quite interested in that. He's an anarchist. You know, he maintains he's an anarchist.
Who?
Cadogan does.
But Healy?
No, that he himself is.
Ah, yes. Sorry, I thought you were talking about Jerry.
You must use the word in a...
Oh, yes.
I don't know if he's a Chomskyan type anarchist.
Yeah, I'd like to meet Chomsky. He was in London a few days ago.
He was. I spoke to him, actually.
Did you? Yes. He's still come back, must have. Yeah.
And actually, he spoke at the...
You told me, yeah.
Central Board. Yeah, like it, banking illegal. Is it true that banking was nationalised in 1946?
I think so, yes.
It seems odd, doesn't it? It seems bizarre. I mean, it must have been controlled before, so
yeah.
I don't understand anything.
Yeah, I can't...
I mean, the idea that it wasn't controlled, it must be a myth, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm talking about the reference to law, yeah, the way people are often influenced by laws which are passed, you know, like essentially husbands are eating fish on Fridays.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I found a reference to a law against swearing, which I think was...
A lot of people... How Puritan?
So it was in about 18... It was repealed in...
But it must come from the sounds of the English Civil War period.
It may have been a religious thing, but
yes.
The point is that, like, you know, the point is that's a big issue that lots of people have on TV, isn't it? They don't mind violence or distortion or deliberate lies.
Yeah.
Crap. One thing they should come back to see. But I also came to that it was illegal. At one point it was illegal for several centuries. It was illegal for to eat three meals a day.
Really? What? No. Why?
I suppose because it was a...
Three meals?
It was a sumptuary law, you know, to make people...
I never knew that. Three meals? I just wanted to make sure that I... What is the time?
Should we walk around and have a look?
I was told the first time. I've never seen this girl.
Yeah, well, have a look. Please have a look. It's a good way.
I wanted to do an expedition to find out where Atlantis was.
Sure,
when he was a minister.
Was Gordon, the other Gordon.
Which one? The General Gordon,
yeah.
Cartoon.
Well, he wanted to try and find the Garden of Eden, didn't he?
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
Read Lytton Strachey. Yeah. Oh, I know about Gladstone. He wrote huge tomes about
he's mad
Homer,
in the hat,
didn't he?
Yeah, I know. He's mad in the hat.
Mad? Very intelligent bloke.
I know. I mean, nicely mad. I like mad people. I try to stand the same people they bore me. What do your parents think about it all?
They ask the same questions you do. What are you going to do with classical civilization?
What?
They always ask me what I'm going to do afterwards.
Oh, their own parents do.
Yeah.
That's tourist view, isn't it?
Huh? Yeah, very materialistic, yeah. I must visit your restaurant one day.
Yeah.
I'm vegetarian. Can you provide?
Yeah, yes.
Vegetarian. Are you doing all right, business-wise?
Yeah.
No wonder you support that trip, can't you?
Yeah, before we had the business, it was a Labour family.
Perfect. Yeah. Well, the business made you late, Tory.
Well, that's the way I'm
feeling. Yeah, I'm sure it's
connected.
It's funny enough, people's position, situation does change your ideology.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of people lived in working class, people lived in Hackney, and they were decanted as that's like, to places like that famous place in Essex, Basildon. And they became, you know, with nothing to do with that lot, we're in the upper bracket.
That's right, well, in America you've got the same thing, which was socialism was regarded, in America, amongst new immigrants, socialism was regarded as being an out-of-date European sort of foreign ideology. Did you say your parents run restaurants? Is that so? Sort of Muslim food or something? Whatever that is.
Thanks a lot of Irish people.
Is your mother Irish Catholic? I'm surprised your father hasn't put his foot down and say, right, what about Islam?
He's not, he calls himself Muslim, and he does believe a lot of things, but he doesn't go to the mosque.
Does he bow down for
yeah, like, and he doesn't really...
It's a bit tiresome, isn't it, sort of this bowing down business?
I don't think he really believes in, and you know, like, women should cover their skin and stuff like that. No sex before marriage, I mean, he's kind of moved on from that, I don't know.
But does he believe in the Catholic Church?
He does not believe
in it,
he doesn't think.
Because I've seen Islam and Catholicism have very little in common.
My mum's very Catholic though.
She believes in it?
Well, not all, but she makes allowances. But
how can you, right, can I, let's make a controversial statement. How can you possibly believe that priests should not be married when in fact one of the rites of the Catholic Church, the priests are married? How do you explain that, my lord?
I don't know what you're
doing. It's rubbish, isn't it?
You've got to take, okay, I don't believe in all these priests in Catholic religion, you can't be a woman priest.
Which is happening in the Church of England.
Yeah, it will happen.
It will happen. It happened in the Catholic Church, but not now.
You've got to take the Bible, see it in the modern day sense a lot, as it does now.
But it's all obvious that the early church actually women were priests. There's no doubt about it.
When you say your mum is a believer, do you mean, I presume most Catholics don't actually know anything about their religion at all, do you mean she just sort of says things like Hail Marys and things like that?
Oh, she wouldn't say anything like that. She doesn't even go to church. She goes in one ear and the other, but she's, she's the one that sort of, when we were kids, would sit down and say our prayers. That would say our own prayers.
She's from Dublin or something like that? Where?
Cavan, near Dublin.
No, the county. Yeah, was that town? Yeah.
Next to Dublin.
That's nice, isn't it? I was there and a couple of months ago. Which would be interesting. Celtic civilization, I think. Also, Near East civilization.
There's a friend of mine in a Trotskyist named Michel Raptus, who lives in Greece, and he's got a Pythagorean society, which is trying to, you know, materialists who are trying to challenge the Platonic, you know, they're trying to re-establish Democritus, you know, Democritus, Greek philosopher.
Yeah.
And Heraclitus?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think. Democritus just came out with my English exactly, funny enough.
And according to Ridley's view, was that a lot of the materialist philosophy had been suppressed.
Yes, was Russell thought that Plato wanted all the works of Democritus suppressed, and his wish was carried out. I mean, I don't think he meant that simply.
Yeah, it could be, yeah.
Yeah, it's Ridley. I'm not thinking of Ridley, am I?
Ridley.
Fay Ridley. He was a famous
historian. He's a great history of the Roman Catholic Church.
Oh right, so he's a friend of McKay.
That's right, like connection, yeah. So what aspect of history interests you particularly?
History apart from McKay.
Mainly Greek history interests you.
I used to do a lot of David's history and things like that.
What aspect particularly interests you? The Reformation?
Tudors, I like doing that.
Oh, what?
Tudors.
The Tudor period?
Yeah.
Well, that was the...
I would have done history, but I would have done history A-level, but I did it for GCSE, and it's all based on evidence, and I've never really smart enough to do it.
What are your brothers doing?
One of my brothers works in the restaurant, and the other one is I was just on a couple of questions. He did English, but I was using history.
So is he going to politics?
No, he's going to
No, that's practical. If there are jobs at the end of it, it's our job.
There's a theory that engineers are... There used to be a theory that engineers were... You know, there was a big shortage of engineers, wasn't there? Is that still true? They still tell them that?
There's a big shortage of women engineers.
Ah, that's true.
That's what we're always told after.
But everything, yeah, they're all trying to get you in on it, aren't they?
Where did you go? What school did you go to?
Blackie High.
Oh, right. Is that well known? Is that well known?
It's quite a small school there, but... Are you from North London?
I lived there for a long time, yeah, at the moment, so I was thinking in West London.
Right.
I know North London quite well.
You cross the river often now?
To East London, yeah.
That's a I give another point. The River Thames is a tremendous cultural boundary. People who live in the south are not, they're two totally different.
Yeah,
am I right?
My friends from the east end of London.
Well, even that's different.
I know.
Once you cross that Waterloo Bridge, you're in a different world. The South London Cockney is different from the East London Cockney.
Definitely, yeah, we're always there.
Amazing.
But, I've been to North London once in my life, I never go up there.
Well, I lived in Norwood for 3 years. Edited 3 volumes of on local government, which is much easier to... I've not got a work for it. No, it's too far back.
You've got work to do now?
Yeah, you're almost there. You've got nothing else to do. Listen to two boring old men, young men.
Let me ask you a few things.
Right, can you listen to me?
Truth about the Russian Revolution.
Tell her what we've been doing.
Oh, we're just talking to each other about random topics and all. You're probably finding excruciatingly dull, actually.
No, that's not a Russian Revolution.
Just 202.
Right, for a few minutes.
There was a speaker at the South Place talking about the Russian Revolution a few months ago. Did you hear any good?
I didn't hear it.
Okay, I just wondered if there was any, did come up with any good things.
Yeah, right.
Do you know about India? Things like Indigo Wars and...
No.
About financial panics in the 19th century?
No, I'm not. Yes, I have here's something about Lewis Carroll, Connection. Amazing.
Really? That's
okay. Yeah, he was in this one. I've deciphered some of these stories in Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland and Alice through the Looking Glass, right? And one story...
What is your modus operandi?
Context.
You read it carefully, you mean?
Now, for example, what were the things... What events were taking place at the time he was writing Alice in Wonderland and Alice in Looking Glass? What were interests?
Right.
Now, one of the... You heard of Tenniel, Sir John Tenniel, who did the cartoons for Alice in Wonderland. That, you know,
the etchings, yeah.
The etchings.
Engravings, yeah,
whatever. Right, yeah. Now, John Tenniel was a political cartoonist, too. He did all the famous punch cartoons. The pilot, the famous one?
Dropping the pilot.
Yeah. Yes, right. And Carroll used him, so he knew he was... I would say Carroll was sort of vaguely conservative. He was supportive of Disraeli. He didn't like Gladstone.
Right.
Now, one of the poets that are quoted in Alice in Wonderland was Humpty Dumpty. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. Well, so what? Why is it there? What's it in, you know, what's the connection? If you read any account of the history of nursery rhymes, you'll find that it's a reference believed to be to Richard Hunchback. Right. Some say King George II, the Battle of Dettingen, in 1743, was thrown by a horse. Some say it was Cromwell
It doesn't matter. What I'm saying, the
can I just ask you, did you read Martin Gardner's book, the Annotated Alice?
Yes, I have.
Oh, right, okay.
Yes, yes. No, so, but he doesn't go into it.
No, yeah. Okay.
So the question is, what is the connection? How does it relate? So, I thought very hard sometimes. But when I was writing my book on the history of services, I was reading the history of the railways, and I found that in a history, a long history, the real problem, of course, is I had a great call. All the King's horses, it was in the reign of Queen Victoria. So where's the King's horse? Mm. All the people put it together. Now, connected with the question you asked earlier on. If he was writing the reign of Queen Victoria, what king could he be referring to? And I found in this biography of the number of the railway entrepreneurs of the last century, and the railway king came tumbling down. There was a man named George Hudson. You know George Hudson? He was one of the entrepreneurs of the last century who built the railway from London to Newcastle.
Yeah.
He was a sort of cruiser. And he managed to get lots and lots of money together, and they built the railway, and then there was a crash, a financial crash. Now, when you read that story, you read Humpty Dumpty again, it fits perfectly. Humpty Dumpty, now if you read this fellow Hudson, is portrayed in Punch cartoons as a fat, paunchy guy.
No, that's correct.
Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. That is like Wall Street. Humpty Dumpty.
Wall Street's in America.
I know, but I mean, it meant the Threadneedle Street. I mean,
yeah,
it was an image.
Yeah, right.
Humpty had a great call. That's what happened. All the King's horses. What is the King's horse? The rail. Some iron horses. A railway. All the King's horses. All the King's men could put it together again. That's exactly what happened to George Hudson. He died in Fleet.
It's really funny. There's a parody of that about Reginald Maudling. Reginald Maudling.
Really?
Reginald Maudling sat on a board. Reginald's partner went down for fraud. All the Queen's council and media men couldn't put Reggie together again.
I didn't know that.
It's so funny. Well, it's prior to time, but it's exactly the same. Maybe
when? Recently? No.
Oh, no. It was when Maudling, 1970.
So you see how I interpret it? Is it possible? I give you one other beautiful interpretation of that.
What about the Jabberwocky?
No, it's too coming. Another very good one. Yes, this shows you have to know about the history. Is the walrus and the carpenter.
Oh, right.
Now, who is the walrus and the carpenter? That's a very difficult thing. It's all about the walrus eating the oysters, right? Now, when was it written? 1860. Here you had the North Prussian Federation, do you know that history? And there was Austria, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and Prussia was slowly expanding to become what became the North German Confederation. And there's a famous battle involving the Italians, the Germans and the Austrians. And in the year 1863, I'm open to correction, the Battle of Sadowa. And the Italians were on the side of the Germans against the Austrians. I looked at various cartoons and I thought, who the hell is this? The walrus. And who's the carpenter? And I looked carefully at the walrus. It's Bismarck.
It's got moustaches.
The moustache, Bismarck. Then who is the man with the cloth cap? It's Cavour. Count Cavour. And you look at it, you see pictures of him. So what is the oyster? What is Latin for oyster?
What is Latin for oyster?
Austria. Eating the oysters.
Right, yeah. Are you saying that would Lewis Carroll have known that? Or is he...
Yeah, I suppose he
would have... collaborate with Tenniel?
Yes, of course he did.
Yeah, but I mean, in the sense of talking about the stuff, you know.
I just think highly likely, yeah. I think it's a sort of gentle humour. I mean, not a vicious humour, it's gentle satire. And
so it's not really nonsense at all, it's just...
It's very profound nonsense. And the other one really amazing.
It's all your own work, or you've not quoted Gardner or somebody?
No, I'm certainly not.
I've
written these articles, I don't know. No, it's quite original.
Okay.
Now, here's one that really shook somebody. Tweedledum and Tweedledee, that's a difficult one. Mm-hmm. On earth could it be? So I was looking at various cartoons, and I came across a very interesting, there was a famous conflict between Napoleon III, even Napoleon III? And he had a cousin called Prince Plonplon. He was a pretender. He was always creating trouble for Napoleon III. And he was the spit image. And he visited Buckingham Palace. And he was a great friend of the Queen Victoria. And I think it's Tweedledum and Tweedledee.
I thought that there was a... Yes. Napoleon III was completely on his own.
No, there's a, and finally, the last one is... yes, right. The commonly accepted interpretation of the Mad Hatter is that some name... name. Some fellow was known in Oxford as a, and he had mercury in the hat.
Walter Pater or something like that.
It doesn't matter. We'll and I was thinking very hard about it, and I wasn't very convinced of the explanation. I thought very hard about the word Mad Hatter. And I was, one morning many years ago, I said, I was talking to myself in the morning, I said, Mad Hatter. And I suddenly said, myself, Mad Adder. Because you know, in language, you go from hard to soft, top to dirt, butter to butter. Is that something? Mad Adder. Mad Adder. Add subtractive line. Who was the great madder of the last century?
A Mad Adder?
Yeah, who was it?
Well, a calculating boy.
Got it. Sir Charles Babbage.
Babbage.
And he was Lucasian professor of mathematics in Cambridge, and he was lecturing mathematics at Christchurch, and I had evidence he met him.
Yeah, it would not be surprising, would it?
So that's who I was thinking. Am I mad?
Hey, did you know Babbage wrote one of the first books on industrial engineering, and like Taylorism? Have you heard of that?
No, but I knew I'd read that. Yeah. Fascinating person. I have to be going in a few minutes.
I was going to ask you about the Labour Party.
I'll take the last one. I'll take the Labour Party, and then I'll go.
Tell me about Ken Livingstone. Tell me whether you think parties are the only way that politics can be done, and whether...
Politics, about the Labour Party.
Well, suppose you've got groups. Is it necessary to have political parties, or is it?
The reality, if you look at the history of this country, that every country has a culture, parties or structures or whatever. If we look at the history of this country, we can clearly establish that the two-party system is, in whatever shape or form, eventually dominates, breaks through, right? And the third party very rarely, in fact there's never been a case where the third party has actually triumphed over the then dominant parties. Mm. All they do is give the majority...
Labour got rid of Liberals.
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, but it's only a replacement. Mm. There's a party of the left in broad terms, or a party of the right in broad terms, right? Like Republicans and Democrats, right?
Yeah.
Now, that being the case, if you take a general left, whatever that means, if you want to change the system, you join a left party. If you are happy with the system, you support the Conservative. I mean, oversimplifying, right? Mm. Now, in my opinion, we are living through an incredible period because we are seeing something that apparently hasn't happened since the turn of the century. A huge dominant party of this country in much of the century is literally blowing itself to be imploding, exploding from within.
Because of the Europe issue, you mean?
Yes. And I remember predicting, and I was quite reckless, before Maggie Thatcher was overthrown, I said to somebody, Europe will bring her down. Europe's bringing down this government again. It's a big issue.
But it's a serious issue, isn't it?
I'm not agreeing with you. Yeah. And it seems to me that there's a possibility of literally an implosion of the government, which we've never seen before. They're literally exploding, falling to pieces. So.
Very.
And we could have a situation like in Canada, Labour sweeping in with a huge majority and just obliterating the Tories for two or three elections. Of course they come back later.
And before, wasn't it? Was reputed happened after the Second World War, I don't think.
No, First World War. No, so second, yeah, because it was the great 1903 when the Campbell Mannon, the Liberal Democrat, Liberals won control in 1903. But apparently it was a split, I didn't know this, but I must read up. Before 1903, a similar split took place in the Tory party between the free traders and the protectionists, I believe. Is that right? It was such a bitter conflict that they literally split apart.
But also because the Liberals... Well, it must have been just after that, mustn't it? The Labour Party came and sort of gazumped the Liberals.
Yeah, but Labour gazumped the Liberals.
Well, I thought, isn't it the case that the Liberals, if the Liberals had accepted Labour as equal, you know, into their party, then there would not have been a Labour Party. The only reason there is a Labour Party is because...
Could be.
What I'm interested in is whether parties are the only way to organise, or whether maybe it's a myth that you can have individualism, like in economics it's a bit of a myth, isn't it, the idea of...
I'm interested in environmental politics, party politics. I think the truth is that it's the way to change things is a subtle combination of both. In other words, environmental politics outside the party system is very effective.
Okay, you infuse a bit of novelty into it.
Yes. Now let me give you the best example. For example, if you set up a Green Party,
people of different political persuasions that join. It was very odd. People even opposing political views. So green issues can bring together people of different persuasions. And, you know, we want to have to keep the green belt, or we want to save wild birds, etc. And it seems to me that to be an effective politician, in the biggest sense of the word, not part of it, you have to have a skill of utilising the existing systems, which you will never replace.
Yeah.
And at the same time, keep in contact with the outside systems, the environmental systems, and use that as a pressure group on your own party.
In your opinion, what is the usual background of people? You see, most people aren't even aware that politics is a possible career. You know, they're, like they're, yeah. they think they must go into the family firm, or they must become professional.
Yeah.
Or they must get, it just doesn't occur to them, but they're not told. You know, like most people don't think of becoming a surgeon. Are most career politicians, is it in the family, would you say? Or do they learn it at... there's a difference between local governments and...
Yes, it's different. You see, the reasons people go into politics are so contrary and contradictory that you can't generalise, you know. You can't generalise. What I would say, there's two kinds of politicians. There are those who just want to do a local thing and not interested in parliament, and those who see it as a jumping off point. You know, counts in order to become an MP or an MEP.
Yeah.
And you can't always tell at the early stages what the game is. But it seems to be tremendous unemployment, a hell of a lot of people going into politics as a job. No question about
it. Wasn't that always the case? Were you,
no, because there isn't anything else.
Yeah,
I mean, I know a lot of unemployed lecturers and teachers. I'm not criticising
them. Oh, really?
Who joined the Labour Party. I mean, there's a person who's unemployed, I won't say who he is, who's a very leading member of the Fire and Civil Defence Corps. I think he earns £20,000 in expenses and committees and what have you. And he's got no other job, you see, and probably couldn't get one either. Which is sad, but...
Yeah,
but... must be going well.
Oh, must be asking about Ken Livingstone.
Oh, yeah, oh, I'll do that. Yeah, Livingstone. Okay, yeah. I'll keep in touch. Bye.
Bye.
See what I can find out.
Okay,
bye. If I was 50 years younger, you're right, 100.
You'd be a bit...
What?
You're not old, eh?
What?
Are you 70?
I know, it's depressing.
I think her knowledge of... It's depressing, isn't it, actually? I think her historical awareness was a...
Great.
Zero.
Yeah, no, right, no, Livingstone, right. So what do you want to know about Livingstone?
I was quite impressed. He used to broadcast on LBC just about a year ago.
The answer to your question about Livingstone is a very interesting person who, like so many people, have... a desire to reach number 10. That's what, if you want to have the story of Livingstone, he wanted to be Prime Minister. Well, he still does, but there's no chance now. And he had a plan to get there. It was to use the GLC as a stumping ground for his national credentials, to get into Parliament through Brent East, overthrow Michael Foot at the time, you know, the young generation against the old, become the leader of the Labour Party and then become Prime Minister. That was all about. Extremely slick, agile, quick on the mark, but very shallow.
Well, his voice, he's got a funny voice.
Surprising as he changed it.
He didn't go into image training, did he?
No. He's a very complex person. He's bisexual.
Is that true? Yes.
Well, it's not a model comment. I make these comments is to explain part of the complexity of their personality. The thing that drives him forward is power. I want to get there.
Why did he take the side of the Irish in London, for example? Wasn't that principle?
No, I don't think so. Well, probably he's sympathetic to him. I don't think it's a real issue. He believes in the idea of the coalition. He believes that if you had a coalition of women, homosexuals, Irish, gays,
rainbow coalition,
that you'd get a majority. The trouble with the argument, this is one of the ideas, is one Well, his deputy once said to me, he said, the arithmetic doesn't even add up, because some of them contradict each other. Because we think Irish people get on with blacks, sure. You're in for a big surprise.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, homosexuals don't get on with lesbians. I mean, none of these are moral comments. Yeah. The idea that everyone's all working together with some great, lovely, right, is rubbish, unfortunately. People are...
There's no homosexual community, is there? I'm reading Tuning Query.
Again, we're not talking about morals, we're talking about real politics. So, he's now... I think he's realised that he's getting old, and he's making overtures to Blair. You know, that I'm the left man, acceptable left man. Use me.
I thought it was very...
I'm drifting towards the station. We'll continue the discussion about some other time.
Well, yeah, I'm interested to...
Yeah. Here we have, we covered a hell of a lot.
Only if the pore has a larger diameter than the thickness of the section and is cut both posteriorly and anteriorly by it, will it be seen at all. The size of the pore will apparently be that of the smallest gap. Obviously, the size of the gap appears will depend on where the hole is in the section. Therefore, we should not expect to see a constant pore size. The circular shape of the pores on plan view leads us to suggest that they are bubbles, and on transverse section they represent cracks in the nuclear membrane. At this point, it would be useful to put forward our suggestions about how the endoplasmic reticulum, the unit membrane, and the nuclear pore originate during preparation for electron microscopy. If we look at this illustration from Wheatley's Introduction to Electron Microscopy, we see a section unstained on the left and stained with heavy metals on the right. Obviously, the image electron microscopist sees is composed only of heavy metal. Furthermore, the two-dimensional appearance of the structures we have been discussing gives us a clue as to their genesis. That is, they must be formed after the sections have been cut. A geometrical line is a fiction because it has position but no thickness. Any real layer has two surfaces. This layer represents a real membrane. Heavy metals like osmium, tungsten and lead are deposited on surfaces of such membranes by electron microscopy. And as we see here, the membrane appears as two parallel lines of heavy metal. Thus, any stain which is a deposit like a heavy metal will never permit us to see a real membrane as one line. This point applies equally to freezing techniques. Although freezing is used for fixation, heavy metals are also used for seeing a tissue. When a tissue is prepared for electron microscope, it contains some embedding medium, some heavy metal, and possibly some tissue. Each of these three components is grossly different with respect to its coefficient of expansion, heat conductivity, affinity for metal, electron density, stability, vapor pressure and compressibility. Let us now look at one of these, the temperature coefficient. The figure for osmium is approximately 1/10 of that of the epoxy resins, and the temperature inside the electron microscope specimen has been measured and is several hundred degrees. Therefore, the tissue, the metal and the embedding medium, with their vastly different coefficients of expansion, will explode if rapidly heated to high temperature, as does a piece of clay in a potter's oven if it contains air bubbles. There is no doubt that, on electron micrographs, one can see the appearance of an endoplasmic reticulum in the cytoplasm of most cells. So that, if one believes it to be an artifact, one should be able to explain it. We can describe the cytoplasm in the living cell as an aqueous suspension, containing, among other constituents, salts, amino acids, fatty acids and many metabolites soluble in water. When the tissue is dehydrated and organic solvents are added for electron microscopy, these solutes must precipitate and insoluble particles will deposit. The distinguished cryobiologist Luyer and his school in Madison have shown the beautiful patterns which may be obtained when various solutions are frozen and then viewed with the electron microscope. These are the patterns made by freezing salts, and these made by freezing amino acids and glycerol. When freezing to below minus 50 degrees occurs, ice crystallizes out and the solute precipitate. However, it is most significant that the particular pattern found depends upon the rate of freezing, the nature of the solutes, the purity of the constituents, and their relative and total concentrations. It is of particular interest that careful examination of their precipitates by electron microscopy often reveals the two-line thick appearance, and these two lines appear to be of a remarkably uniform distance apart. Is this a model for the unit membrane? Finally, let us go back to an intracellular structure that predates the electron microscope. The Golgi apparatus appeared to Golgi as a uniform net distributed within the cytoplasm. To later light microscopists like Born, it appeared as a paranuclear mass of about the same total diameter as that of the nucleus. And to Holmgren, it was a shell of granules spherically distributed around the nucleus. The controversy as to whether the Golgi apparatus was real or was a fixation or staining artifact was considered to have been settled when the body was seen by the electron microscope. This is a typical picture of its lamellar structure, and its appearance at this magnification is extremely uniform throughout all tissues. However, when we compare the appearance and dimensions of the Golgi apparatus, firstly as seen by Golgi, secondly by the later light microscopists, and thirdly by the electron microscopists, it becomes abundantly clear that they were looking at quite different objects. For example, Golgi's network looks nothing like the electron microscopist's onion-like lamellar structure. The paranuclear Golgi apparatus is never less than 8 to 10 microns in diameter, but the electron microscopist is never more than 2 microns. Although early phase contrast microscopists like Ludford claimed to have seen the Golgi apparatus in unstained preparations, it must have been several orders larger than the lamellar structure seen by the electron microscopists. We can now reconsider the structure of the living cell in the light of the present discussion after having shaved off unnecessary hypotheses by the unsparing use of Occam's razor. All intracellular structures are moving continuously and at different speeds. If we were to stop this movement and draw the generalized cell, it would look like this diagram. The membranes around the cell, the nucleus, the mitochondria, and probably the nucleolus are of single thickness and are imperforate. There is no endoplasmic reticulum or Golgi apparatus. The lysosomes have not been considered in this discussion. The nucleolonema is present in the nucleolus. Unhappily, it is a picture remarkably like that which had been revealed by the 1890s, with the sole exception of the further detail of the nucleolus. The lessons that come out of these considerations are, firstly, that we should always assess the validity of any structural findings in cells by their compatibility with observations on living tissue. And, secondly, that we should pay much more attention to the possible, indeed probable, effects of our preparative techniques upon the appearance of cells.
There are credits now, marking the end of the film. We wish to thank the following authors and publishers for the use of illustrations, and there are 14 names, including W. Bloom, J. Brachet, and at the end L.T. Threadgold, and B. Weekly. It says here, Academic Press, Inc., Churchill Livingstone Limited, W.H. Freeman and Company, Pergamon Press, W.B. Saunders. They must be publishers. It says, made for Harold Hillman, Unity Laboratory, Department of Human Biology and Health, University of Surrey, Guildford, Surrey, in collaboration with Peter K. Sartori. That's the only reference to Sartori in the film. and it mentions the Audiovisual Centre, University of London, and the Audiovisual Aids Unit, University of Surrey. And that's the end of the film. It's roughly 26 minutes.